Street Committee to order. It is 1:02 p.m. on Monday, April 26, 2021. Before we begin, I want to thank Shannon McCann, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Tom Raymond from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. This time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Christ Tompkins, Representative Drummond, my Vice Chair, Representative Snyder, and myself, Representative Clayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is House Bill 142, PFD Eligibility, sponsored by Representative McCarty. This is the second hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee. Our office did not receive any amendments to House Bill 142. That brings House Bill 142 back before the committee. I'd recognize that Representative Eastman joined us today at 1:03 p.m. And we're to final comments. I'm going to give members of the committee, as usual, one opportunity for my final comments. Representative Vance would be up, but she's not here. So, Representative Eastman, any comments on House Bill 142?
Oh, I think my my comments are going to be that it was interesting what we heard in our last hearing dealing with, you know, how separately we've treated military in the statute. And while that may be important to have that separation going forward, I would certainly be very concerned if we allow that separation to give greater preference to other types of service than military service, just because military service is longer and more encompassing. I don't think that should be any reason why we give it any less consideration or less of a priority or value in our statute than, say, working in the congressional offices in D.C. or any other reason that takes people out of state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Love the bill. Can't wait to hear it again. It's already noticed in State Affairs this week, and I really appreciate Representative McCarty carrying it.
Snyder.
Nothing to add.
Representative Drummond. All right. And I really don't have anything to add. So, and Representative Vance joined us. It's now 1:04 p.m. May I have a motion?
Yes. I move version 32-LS0491/I of House Bill 142 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Hearing no objection, House Bill 142 moves from committee. Please be sure to sign the paperwork as it circulates while we continue on with our next order of business. Our second and final order of business, and Representative McCarty, thank you for joining us for a short few minutes here. Our second and final order of business today is House Joint Resolution 1, Constitutional Amendment, Permanent Fund, POMV Earnings, sponsored by Representative Christ Tompkins. This is the first hearing of the joint resolution in the House Judiciary Committee. Here to present the joint resolution is Representative Christ Tompkins. If you could identify yourself for the record and you can begin your remarks. I was going to tell you you're welcome to stay in your seat, but you've made your choice. So, and please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm pleased to do some tourism within the room. HJR 1 is a constitutional amendment that creates a simple and hard POMV framework for the permanent fund. It combines the ERA into the principal. It creates an unbreakable spending limit on how much the legislature can spend out of the permanent fund in any single year. It's predicated on a number of resolutions and statements from the APFC Board of Trustees and literally decades of thinking about Alaska's fiscal future. And it's agnostic on the dividend and public services for that matter, although each member I'm sure will sort of read into what may happen as they will, and I think that's probably where the discussion will lead us. But from my perspective, this puts the legislature in a balanced budget box from which it cannot exit It will have to balance the budget. There are no other options. It will have to cut spending and or raise revenues, and it will not be able to subsidize unbalanced budgets by spending down the permanent fund in order to suspend a basically unsustainable fiscal reality that we are currently living in.
Thank you very much. Before we get to questions, I want to start with invited testimony and the first presentation from our first invited testifier, and that's Ian Lang, Executive Director of the Institute of the North. Mr. Lang is on Teams, and there's a presentation as well on the screen. So, Mr. Lang, if you want to state your name for the record, please proceed with your invited testimony.
Okay, thank you. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Okay, I am getting a big echo, so I'm not going to listen to it, but just give me a visual signal if you want to stop me. Oh, there we go. Okay, thank you. As you said, my name is Ian Lang. I'm the Executive Director of the Institute of the North. For anybody who's not familiar with us, we are a nonpartisan think tank. We're based in Anchorage, founded by former Governor Hickel, and our mission is really focused on helping to ensure that we get the most public benefit from the resources that we share. And if that sounds vaguely familiar, it's because we lifted that mission right out of the state constitution, specifically Article 8, where we talk about maximum public benefit from our resources. And we are interested in this bill, of course, because one of those great common resources is very much at risk today. And I'm referring, of course, to the permanent fund. There's a quote by Jay Hammond I like. He said after the Conference of Alaska in 2004, he said, we had dropped in our laps a monstrous golden goose egg, but how we burnish it, tarnish it, or crack it wide open will be a legacy for years to come. And I mention this because we've really reached a moment where we are deciding whether or not we are going to crack it wide open. We haven't done it yet, but that is the trajectory we were on. And if we acknowledge that, we acknowledge the consequences of that trajectory and the timing involved here, we'll see that we have a fairly narrow window to act. If we don't protect the permanent fund today, we will most likely begin spending it down the next few years. And in the long run, that can only result in some combination of higher taxes than we might have otherwise had, greater service reductions than we might have otherwise had, and elimination of dividends. And it doesn't really matter which combination of those you think is best. In aggregate, we will be in a worse position. So I really sincerely appreciate you taking the time to hear this bill, because we believe that there is nothing more important to the future of this state than ensuring that the permanent fund remains permanent, that it is used prudently. This is the thing. And there are two main points I want to make, and I'm really just expanding upon what the bill sponsor just said, but namely that this is good policy and it's good strategy. This, you know, sustainable use of the permanent fund has always been recognized as the cornerstone of the state's financial future. But given where we are with our reliance on savings, it's more than that. It is good strategy, and I'll go so far as to say that that prioritizing this amendment is the single best strategy we have towards driving resolution of the larger fiscal challenge. Representative Chris Tompkins mentioned, this is an old idea. The concept of a constitutional limitation on spending from the permanent fund, or we call it the constitutional POMV, this has been around almost as long as I've been alive. It is the most studied, thoroughly vetted, widely supported, but unimplemented idea in Alaska public policy that I know of. It was suggested by, next slide, please. It was suggested by Hugh Malone, who was one of the founders of the permanent fund itself back in the 80s. In 1995, it was recommended by the Long-Range Fiscal Planning Commission. It has been a consistent recommendation of the Board of Trustees for over 20 years. They've issued four resolutions in support of this idea. And this slide, as you can see, is getting a little jumbled, so I didn't add everything in here, but this leaves out the principles and interest project of 1997-98, which included over 100 public meetings around the state. Does not talk about the Conference of Alaskans in 2004, both major undertakings with consistent outcomes recommending this approach. It doesn't mention the dozens of academic papers and letters or the numerous endorsements from major organizations around the state. Since the fund was created, some version of this bill that you were looking at has been introduced 37 times. It's an old idea, it's a good idea, and it is an idea whose time has come. Next slide, please. Because this budget imbalance is still the biggest issue that we face. You know, over the last 7 or 8 years, we have cut spending by 40%, and we've spent $17 billion in savings. And the question we have to focus on now is, how does it end? What can we learn from the last 7 years about where this is headed, and how do we change that outcome? Next slide, please. So there are a couple of key takeaways. I think next slide, please. A couple of key takeaways is that Alaska's fiscal policy is uniquely complex, as you all know. It has many sides, and it has so far proved very difficult for the legislature to broker some grand bargain to close the gap. And what we've tried year after year after year after year after year after year is sending a new group down, people get educated, they work hard, they debate, but in the end, we get high-centered on this really complicated problem and we default to the path of least resistance. That's just the nature of the problem. And that has always been to spend savings. And it is difficult to see a different outcome given the same fundamental constraints. And the lesson that we really take away from that is that so long as savings are accessible, savings are going to be used. Next slide, please.
And while we're turning
what
to
that means,
hold just a second. I'd recognize Representative Kirka joined us at 1:08 p.m. if you can proceed then. Thank you.
And what that really means is that by default, spending down the permanent fund is Alaska's default fiscal plan. That is the plan that we have in place. And it is really a tragedy of the commons as we move towards this outcome that no one really wants, but we all feel a little powerless to prevent because we haven't so far been able to drive compromise. And I believe that this resolution can actually help act as a vehicle for driving that compromise. We'll come back to this in a moment. So next slide, please. One other interesting thing that happened in the last few years, and you are all aware of this, but I think it perhaps escaped a bit of public attention, is that we became an endowment state. We implemented this statutory POMV model for using the permanent fund. We started using it to support government services in addition to paying dividends. And that is a really marked a major shift for Alaska because we went from a state that had been supported 90% from oil revenues to now 65 to 75% of our money coming from the permanent fund. So, you know, prudent stewardship of those funds is even more important than it once was. And while we've been acting as an endowment state, we don't actually have the protections in place to ensure that the endowment itself continues to function the way that it needs to. And there are three basic arguments. Next slide. Just technical, financial, and philosophical. Next slide. A year or two ago, the permanent fund did an analysis and they looked at what is the likelihood that working out of the permanent fund the way we are today, that we'll be unable to get the money out that we need for this statutory POMV draw. And they looked back over 100 years, they broke it up into 20-year increments, and they said, okay, what if the market performs during the next 20 years it did during those previous 20-year increments? And the finding was basically 50% chance that we would be unable to get the money out. So it's hard to quantify the impacts of that exactly, but it would not be good. And it's important to note, I think, that this analysis did assume that the legislature continued to inflation-proof. And if you don't do that, it actually dramatically decreases the risk here, this 50% chance of failure. But it also assumes that you don't overdraw. And I think we've already seen the appetite for this. So still something to think about as we move forward. Next slide, please. Of course, the more obvious issue here is the simple financial prudence of unsustainable spending on the fund. Smaller fund, fewer earnings. You're all familiar with these numbers, but for every $1 billion that we spend from the fund today, we give up about $50 million each year in the future forever. So for context, the $17 billion that we've spent over the past 7 years, if that had remained in the fund and were generating interest, that would now be producing $850 million that we could be using to plug the gap or pay dividends. That would actually translate to a $1,350 dividend that could be paid in perpetuity forever, but that is just something that we will live with. And what we're really looking at moving forward, next slide, please, is doubling down on that approach, because the $17 billion that we've spent since 2013 is roughly equivalent to the $17 billion that is in the earnings reserve of the permanent fund today. And if we do not protect the fund today, we allow ourselves to start spending that down in the next few years, just imagine trying to solve the problem that you're trying to solve today, but doing it in an environment where the permanent fund is generating $850 million less, that only can result in higher taxes, lower services, or elimination of dividends. And I'm oversimplifying the issue here, of course. But the main point is that this will never get easier. The decisions will always be hard. It will only become more essential. Next slide, please. And the third reason here to not spend down the fund is simply that it's not our money to spend just because we can. We have access to this subaccount. That doesn't mean that it's just ours to spend at our discretion. The fund was always created as this vehicle for converting non-renewable resources to renewable wealth. In fact, this was a finding of the Interest and Principles Project in 1978 and 97 that I referred to earlier, which found that Alaskans expect the permanent fund to be permanent and an inheritance to be passed on to future generations. Since the fund was created, we've made about $150 billion in oil revenues, and we've saved only 13.5% of that for the future. And the idea that we would spend down that very modest inheritance because we could not or would not resolve our own problems is just a very tragic legacy for us to leave. Next slide, please. So we have to keep in mind that this budget gap we've been dealing with for a long time, it will eventually be closed. We can't do this forever. The only question is when. We can do it now or we can do it later. And there's no better deal in the future than the deal that we can strike today. If we don't protect the fund today, we'll be we'll most likely begin spending it down. In the long run, that just results, like I said, in higher taxes, lower services, elimination of dividends. It doesn't matter what your values or your politics or your beliefs are. Everyone shares a common interest in preserving the long-term value of the fund. And beyond that, it's our duty to do so. So next slide, please. Like I mentioned, this is as much about strategy as it is policy. We need to get a deal, and I believe very strongly that the very best way to get that deal is by giving ourselves a deadline. And that is another thing that this resolution does. If we pass this year or next year, it goes on the ballot in 2022 and into effect in 2023, or later, you can extend the effective date. That's the deadline after which we're no longer going to allow unstructured spending from the earnings reserve. And that deadline is what is going to drive negotiations on these other aspects of the fiscal conversation in a way that we haven't experienced before. It gives us a few years to figure it out, gives us a runway, but you have to figure it out. Next slide, please. One more comment on timing. We only have one shot to do this every 2 years. And the closer we get to an election, the more difficult it is, as you know, to get anything through. So if we miss this window and we do not put some form of this constitutional amendment before voters in 2022, the next shot that we would actually have for an amendment like this to take effect would not be until 2025. So the question I would put to you is, if we have to wait until 2025, what are the chances that we will have already started to spend down the permanent fund? I mean, I could tell you my personal opinion is very low. So from this point forward, every year that we fail to get a measure like this through, the future of Alaska is compromised to some extent. So I urge you to pass this resolution, continue to work on a comprehensive fix, but no matter what else happens, make sure to put the one piece of a sustainable fiscal plan in place that everyone has agreed on for decades. Do this one thing and the rest will follow. And a final comment, next slide, on constitutional changes here. As everyone in this committee is, of course, aware, constitutional changes require a very high degree of public consensus for a reason. Because the document that we are amending here speaks to what really constitutes us all as Alaskans. And so in the context of the permanent fund, we have to ask ourselves who we really are. What do we represent? What do we stand for? Will we act to protect the long-term interests of this state? Because the decisions that we're making here today, either through action or inaction, will reflect on our own constitutions in one way or another. So as you can tell, this is something very near and dear to my heart. I sincerely appreciate you giving me a chance to speak on it today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Christ Tompkins, I see Ms. Rodell is here. Do you want her to present before we take questions, or do you want to have us turn to questions at this point?
I think that would be advisable, but I defer to your...
Ms. Rodell, if you want to come forward. Our next invited testimony is Angela Rodell, Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Mr. Rodell, welcome to the first floor. It's a different view than you get up in the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be here. For the record, my name is Angela Rodell. I am the CEO, Executive Director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, and you're right, I don't find myself before House Judiciary very often.
I think this is the first time since I've been chair. Welcome.
Thank you. I am pleased, though, to be here to talk to you about the constitutional amendment that you're considering before you. And as has been said, but I'll say it again, the trustees have been on record for 20 plus years now as supporting a constitutional amendment to enact a 5% of market value spending limit and to protect the entire fund by eliminating the distinction between the earnings reserve account and the principal of the fund. A POMV structure will establish a limit on the amount that can be drawn from the fund, and it is based on an average annual market value over a period of 5 years, thus taking out much of the volatility of revenues for the state and enacting a stability that I think is so important. It also allows the fund to be sustainable and to benefit all the generations of Alaskans. It protects the fund's value through constitutional inflation proofing, and it does provide a payout method that is compatible with the investment policy and asset allocation strategy of the fund. In 2000, 2003, 2004, the Board of Trustees adopted resolutions to implement a constitutional POMV. They have supported that continuously. In 2018, they endorsed creating a legal framework that would ensure the long-term success and sustainability of the fund. And then in 2020, they made a point of bringing up all of these previous resolutions and re-endorsing those resolutions to make clear that they believed it was in the fund's long-term sustainable best interest to have a single fund, lose the distinction between the earnings reserve account and the principal, and to have this permanent sustainable draw. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to take any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. We will take questions. We have a For those that have not testified before, we limit the questions to 1 minute, but they can ask more than one question. And I see Representative Eastman had his hand up. Go ahead, Representative Eastman.
And through the chair. Now, the positions that you just articulated from the trustees, is that a unanimous position or is there a minority view?
Through the chair, that is a unanimous position.
Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is question is for Mr. Riddell regarding the 5% of not more than a 5% POMV, and we've heard concerns about that being too high for long-term growth of the fund. Can you give us more insight on what you think that it should be as the legislature, if this were to pass? It says that we can't go above that, but what would your recommendation be for the future growth of the fund?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, the trustees have as their long-term return objective for the fund at 5% plus CPI. So the idea is that the fund will grow, will stay through inflation, will not sort of fall behind because inflation is exceeding its growth capability. And then when you draw on a POMV, because it's an average over 5 years and not a year over year calculation, it actually makes the effective draw, as long as the fund is growing, less than the nominal amount. So right now the draw amount is closer to 4.4% for this year. When you have years where we're losing money or we have flat growth, you'll see that number creep up, and it could be a year where it might look like the effective rate is 5.1 or 5.2, but when you look at it over a period of 10, 20 years, you'll see that it's fairly level and stable, and that's what's going to keep the fund intact, is that stability.
Follow-up?
Representative Vance.
Thank you for that. I've also, with the large amount of federal dollars that is being distributed all across the U.S., I've heard concerns of the possibility of hyperinflation. Is that something that the corporation is looking at and considering in light of the projections? Will that impact the investments?
Through the chair, I would expect, Representative Vance, that if there is hyperinflation, it will affect the fund, and it'll affect it through different asset classes, whether it's in our fixed income portfolio. So if you have something like hyperinflation on bonds, you are not able to reinvest at the same price. You can't keep the same value in your fixed income portfolio, and so it suppresses growth of the fund. There are a number of people who are saying, but then you'll have rapid growth in your inflation assets like stocks, in like real estate. So that's why we have a diversity in our asset class, is to account for different markets being affected differently. And so I would hope that we would be able to continue to manage through with that diverse asset allocation.
All right, thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. Now, you mentioned that the trustees had recommended no more than 5% plus CPI. Of course, that's different than the proposal here. Can you speak to the differences?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, our long-term return objective of is 5% real plus CPI, so whatever inflation is. So if inflation is 2%, which is the forecasted inflation rate for the next 10 years, that means you would earn maybe a nominal rate over that 10-year period of 7%. And what is being addressed here in the constitutional amendment is to take a nominal 5% out. And so it is a calculation that you calculate that straight 5% on. It doesn't have an inflation adjustment to it like our return hurdle does, but it doesn't need it because it's going to be captured in the market value. The inflation portion of it is going to be captured. So they're slightly different, but they should move in the same direction together.
Thank you.
I don't see any other questions. Representative Eastman, I thought you were done.
Thank you again, through the chair. And what are the trustees' views on allowing the legislature to take into account significant inflation, you know, in a given year or outside of the, you know, last first five of the preceding six? Certainly, if you have a significant inflation event in one year, under the current recommendation here in the bill, we see that there's going to be a significant delay before the legislature is allowed to draw based on that inflation.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I think that's the intent, though, of having the POMV so in the Constitution, in the sense that no matter what the event is, either up or down, right, that there creates a set of rules by which everyone is operating under, and there's not volatility within the draws, that there's stability in those draws in following those rules. And it creates a stability that I think is really important for managing the fund long term. And our view, and the trustees' view, is managing for the fund in perpetuity. It's not for one budget cycle.
Thank you.
It strikes me that when you're targeting for management to be 5% plus inflation in terms of your overall success, but the POMV is only 5%. At some level, the size of the fund, if managed effectively, will kind of adjust for that, but it'll always be a little bit behind your investment objective at the same time. At least it strikes me that way. I may be missing something, but.
No, in theory, that's exactly what you want it. You want the fund to be able to grow ahead of those draws.
Right.
So in theory, that should work, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This question is for the maker of the bill. And the question is, why did you choose to leave the percentage of royalties at 25% rather than having it at 50% to align with statute?
Representative Vance, through the chair, can you speak to the 50% of royalties in statute reference, just to make sure I'm tracking that part of the question?
If I'm not mistaken, don't we have a statute that says that the legislature could deposit up to 50% of the royalties, DNR? Am I thinking of something else?
through the chair, I'm actually not familiar with that statute, but regardless of my familiarity with that statute, I mean, it is an area of interest and curiosity for me. I've just never looked into it. I think the theme of this resolution is to help put the legislature in a place where it has to make difficult but responsible decisions for the long term. And from my personal vantage, now I defer to the will of the committee and the legislature ultimately, but additional policy calls in that theme, including potentially nudging upwards the percentage of royalties that are directly deposited into the permanent fund, or and Representative Eastman has previously identified this as a possible policy call, encompassing the royalties of other kinds of natural resource revenues that the state may generate, albeit I'm not sure there's substantial amount there to be sort of encompassed, and then directing those in the permanent fund. I would see that all as additional options that could totally merit consideration, because the implication of those decisions is it will starve us of a little revenue in the short term, but it will make the long-term future of the state, it will provide more resources for future generations, which is a outcome I'm very attracted to.
Follow up?
Representative Vance.
Well, I've been having conversations and would love to entertain the idea of increasing the 25% higher, because the purpose is to take the non-renewable into that renewable source of, you know, essentially green money, right, in the fund. And we see that Alaska is moving into, you know, the endowment state, and we are relying on the POMV more and more. So if we're going to make the best use of our funds, I believe we should be looking at the fuller picture of what it would take to be able to transition to using that money more responsibly and whatever dials that we can use. Now, obviously, you know that my thoughts are that we need to have a permanent fund, a dividend included in this, but I think now is an opportunity to talk about the effects that increasing the 25% would be. And for my question, Mr. Chairman.
Running out of time, Representative Vance.
I have a question for Mr. Lang. Does the Institute of the North have a position on the percentage of royalties to go into the fund?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, we don't have an official position. We haven't written a paper on it, so to speak, but we've had informal conversations. And our predisposition at the Institute is towards intergenerational equality. So I think the idea of saving more of our non-renewable wealth in the permanent fund is something that we would be very supportive of.
Thank you.
Representative Kirka.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not through the chair, Mr. Representative Chris Tompkins. Noticing here on line 8, page 1, looks like you chose to remove the words "only" and "those" in reference to the legislature deciding which income-producing investments are allowed. I guess what's the thought process behind removing those words?
Through the chair. The short answer is I could not say authoritatively, but I would defer to Ms. Nauman in Legislative Legal or Mr. Painter at Legislative Finance. Although my understanding is that this is sort of a conforming or cosmetic change and not substantive.
I would note that we have both Alexi Painter, Director of Legislative Finance, is available on the telephone, as well as Emily Nauman, Deputy Director of Legislative Legal Services. Would you like, well, actually, we'll start with Ms. Nauman because they're responsible for drafting. Ms. Nauman, did you hear Representative Kirk's question, Representative Christ-Tompkins' initial answer? Do you have a perspective on that question?
Chair Klayman, this is Emily Nauman with Legislative Legal Services. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Through the chair to Representative Kirka, the reason that language was taken out is because the way the draw is restructured to a percent of market value rather than an earnings draw, that it's possible, or I guess it's the income of the fund is no longer the source of the draw. Therefore, I think the only those income-producing investments was taken out to conform to the idea that the draw could come from both the now the mixed together corpus and the income, and not necessarily it would be only the income that would be drawn.
Paul, Representative Kirkley, you look, your expression looks quizzical.
Yeah, now I think, Mr. Chairman, now I'm confused because the language I'm looking at here, it would seem to me that that particular statement or that sentence, we're not talking about what the revenue of the fund is, what's happening with that, but we're talking about the money going into the fund and how it's invested.
Mm-hmm.
And before we were saying only for those income-producing investments specifically designated by law. We're still saying that, but we're getting rid of, we're making the language weaker, so to speak, if I'm reading correctly. Because they still are limited to what the legislature in law decides is eligible for permanent fund investments. But the language is weaker, less restrictive, I guess.
So just by way of example, if the legislature were to say, with the current language in the constitutional amendment, to say we can invest in stocks and bonds, but we can't invest in savings accounts that are just straight savings accounts, this would allow them to add things that we could invest in things now that we couldn't invest in. Well, with the amendment passing, we could invest in things that we couldn't invest in now, is how I, if that's how you're reading this as well, Representative Kirga.
No, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It does seem like a style change, but the language fundamentally becomes weaker in that the way I would read it, the permanent fund is still limited by what we decide by law, but it the strong language of only for those income, you know, investments specifically designated by law. The answer from legal seems to be looking at, I guess the answer didn't make sense.
Ms. Nauman?
Through the chair to Representative Kirka, yes, I apologize. I had misunderstood the intent of your question. Previously, I guess I was answering why the principle of was taken out, and that's because the designation between the principal and the income is no longer relevant. But I
right.
do see your point. I would not interpret that sentence any differently with those two words removed. I believe the word shall in that sentence on page 1, line 8, still requires the income-producing investments to be designated by law as eligible for the permanent fund investments, and would suggest that taking out only those is just a style change in conformance with streamlining that sentence.
Okay.
Any follow-up?
I think she answered my question.
Okay. And did you want any input from Alexi Painter on the same topic, or are you satisfied?
I'm good.
Okay. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. I would just respond as I'm looking at line 8. I think the operative language is actually the first three words we're removing. And under the Constitution currently, we have a prohibition specifically against using the principal towards things that are not authorized in statute. But we don't speak to using, you know, the income, which, of course, is continuing to be invested as long as it's in the earnings reserve account. So I see this language as actually more restrictive. It may not actually change any policies, but constitutionally speaking, we're going from a somewhat less restrictive to more restrictive language so that neither the principal or the income going forward will be able to use for that which is not statutorily authorized.
It sounds like a comment and not a question. All right, any other questions? Hearing and seeing none, we're going to turn to public testimony. I'm going to open public testimony on HJR1. I see no one in the room to provide public testimony online. It looks like we have two people that have called in to provide public testimony. The first, Charles McKee. Mr. McKee, if you want to proceed with your public testimony, as you know, public testimony in this committee is limited to 2 minutes. You can proceed. Please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, my name is Charles McKee. I'm the beneficiary of the McKee Trust. And am I speaking to Matt Klayman, the chairman of this hearing?
Mr. McKee, you're speaking to the whole committee.
Okay, well, I mean, through the chair, I want to address Chris Tompkin and the originator of this legislation. I want to point out the fact that court-imposed injunction, or imposed injunction is what you're basically going for. And it was a year, 2 years ago yesterday, that I got in trouble when I killed the House fish tax bill that he was, not the chairman, but the sub-chair with Bert Stedman. And that got me in trouble with the governor, and now I'm facing criminal charges. But I want to point out the fact that the First Amendment guarantees me the freedom of speech, but also gives me, guarantees me the exercise of religious requirements and procedural rules and to be interpreted flexibly. So I point out this, and that's why I sent down to you the certification of business name license. You notice where this says Charles McKee in bold print, cap, and I'm owner, Charles McKee. So when you are sworn into court, a criminal court, as an example, such as myself, and you take the oath, you're standing in a dead zone, a legal fishing arena. So whatever you say comes out, all cap, the dead name. And you don't know that. And so when the judge speaking for the court, representing the court, ask you who you are after you've taken that oath.
Mr. McKee, you're at the 2 minute mark. If you could please conclude your remarks, that would be great.
Well, if you say your name, then you're going to be the court will impose an injunction on you, and you don't have any rights to.
Thank you very much, Mr. McKee. Next in the queue, we have Cliff Groh. Mr. Groh, if you want to state your name for the record, you can proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Cliff Groh. I'm a lifelong Alaskan who lives in Anchorage. I support House Joint Resolution 1. I offer this support based on my more than four decades of experience working in Alaska fiscal policy. The experience that I have includes my work helping to create the permanent fund dividend. I was a legislative assistant who worked by far the most on the bill establishing the dividend in 1982. I've written more about the creation of the dividend than anyone else, given I've lived that creation. I spend much of my time speaking about Alaska's fiscal crisis, and I average about one presentation per week on the topic. Adoption of this proposed constitutional amendment is critical, but insufficient to address the state of Alaska's fiscal crisis. And asking this proposed constitutional amendment would help force a solution to Alaska's giant structural deficit. But this measure by itself would not be the solution itself. The Alaska legislature needs to take other steps as well, including the passage of legislation raising additional revenues and the maintenance of discipline in the budget, which has fallen, as has been pointed out, by more than 40% in the last 8 years. I offer written testimony anyone can read in the form of three books or booklets I have published that are available for free download at www.cliffgroh.org, Cliff Groh being C-L-I-F-F-G-R-O-H. I'm going to conclude briefly by responding to a question a friend of mine asked me this morning, which is, why hasn't this amendment passed before? And I responded in part by pointing to things like inertia and the multiple veto points that are established by the Alaska Constitution requiring the House, the Senate, the people of Alaska in office, if not a veto by the governor to get a constitutional on the ballot, perhaps an override. I also want to point out that the option of spending all the permanent fund earnings is the backup plan for a number of factions or groups that can't agree on anything else. They think that, well, if I can't get my preferred option, at least I can avoid one I don't like by spending the savings.
Mr. Groh, you two are at the two-minute mark. If you could conclude your remarks, that would be great.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. I think it's particularly true this status as a backup option for people who plan to leave the state before a crash would come. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. I don't see anyone else in the room or anyone else online who would like to provide public testimony, so I'm going to close public testimony on House Bill or House Joint Resolution 1. And I'll give the committee one more chance before Ms. Rodell leaves. Representative Christ Tompkins will be back, but Representative Eastman, I see you have another question. Go ahead.
Thank you. Yes.
And is it four?
Is Ms. Nauman still on the line?
Ms. Nauman, are you still with us? I think she is. Ms. Nauman, can you hear us?
Yes, I'm still here.
All right, Representative Eastman, go ahead.
Oh, good, thank you. Ms. Nauman, I'm just curious. So should this bill be passed by the legislature and go before the people and not be approved? I'm looking at the Constitution. I see that it specifically spells out what happens if it is approved and it's added to the Constitution and so forth. But if it's not approved, say it's a tie vote and it doesn't pass, is the amendment self-expiring so that it's kind of a one-shot, one try? Or is there a scenario under which the lieutenant governor or somehow this amendment could appear on the ballot again without the legislature or a future legislature putting it on the ballot again? Thank you.
And Ms. Nauman, I actually want you to answer that question just in the context of it loses. I don't want to go down the rabbit hole of what happens if it actually ties and there's all these lawsuits and whatnot to see whether it's really still a tie after the court has done all these things and everything else.
Just thank you. Yep.
Answer the question that it lost at the ballot.
For the record, this is Emily Nauman with the Legislative Legal Services through the chair to Representative Eastman. I've actually never thought about this question before, but my educated guess, having done this a while, is that if the vote failed at the ballot, that the amendment would not be able to be proposed at a subsequent election without the legislature again passing a second resolution authorizing the issue to be on the ballot again.
Thank you.
Just a question following up on Representative Eastman. Could we, the next session, pass an identical resolution, or would we have to change it by one or two words to make it slightly different?
Chair Klayman, I see no restriction that would prevent the legislature from using the same language again to avoid the double negative. Yes, I believe that the legislature could pass an identical resolution proposing an identical amendment.
All right. Thank you very much. Now, I really see no other questions, so we are going to hold this bill, this joint resolution, for further review. If you're considering an amendment to House Joint Resolution 1, please let our office know. Submit that amendment electronically by 5 p.m. this Thursday, April 29th. The plan will be to actually hear this bill again on Friday the 30th. We will now adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Wednesday, April 28th at 1 p.m., and again, if you've got an amendment for HJR 1, it's due on Thursday at 5, and we will stand adjourned. The time now is 1:54 p.m.